welcome to Hazel and Katniss and Harry and Star, a young adult literature podcast, their film and television adaptations, and everything in between. I'm Joe.
And I'm Brenna.
And our show is located on the ancestral lands of the Haudenosaunee, the Huron-Wendat, and the Anishinaabe on lands connected to the Toronto Purchase, Treaty 13 of 1805.
And on the Tecumloops Te-Sequeptan territory within the unceded traditional lands of Sequeptan Ulu. And today's text, Turtles All the Way Down, takes place in Indianapolis, Indiana, the traditional home of the Miamia, Kaskaskia, and Kickapoo peoples. Joe.
Yes.
Welcome back to John Greenland.
Yes. And as we discovered in between the week of announcing this and now covering this, this could possibly be the last time we ever cover John Green because he has said he's done with YA fiction.
Yes. And we'll talk about that when we talk about the end of the novel, because Green says he knew when he was ending the novel that he was saying goodbye to, as he says, quote, a particular kind of storytelling. So we'll get into all of that today. But I am just curious off the top before we dig into the text itself.
Right.
You have traditionally not been a John Green fan.
Right.
What are your sort of initial impressions of Turtles All the Way Down?
So I messaged you early on and said, "Ooh, I'm having the same issue as I had with The Fault in Our Stars, where I was struggling to connect the voice of the text, which is a teen girl, and it felt very much John Green-y to me all over again." I got by it in about 50 to 75 pages, and I ended up mostly enjoying this. I will confess, this feels like a very different kind of story, like not just, you know, oh, it's different from other people because it's John Green, but rather this is an unusual subject for YA. It feels almost antithetical to what we would normally be talking about.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think this is his strongest novel, mostly because I think he's resisting a lot of the...
It's not a romance.
Yeah, it's not a romance. And, you know, the thing with John Green is, so all his protagonists are young men, and we didn't like any of them up until The Fault in Our Stars. And, you know, this is by far John Green's most personal book. The protagonist of this book struggles with obsessive compulsive disorder, which Green also does. And he really wanted to write a story about what that experience feels like, because he felt like it was not ever dealt with in media appropriately. And I've certainly never seen it dealt with like this. Like, there are moments in this book that are so...
Oh, it's tough. Tense. It's really tough.
It's really tough. And I asked you at one point when we were chatting, like, why do you think he bothered making this a female character? Because it's so obviously so deeply connected to his experience. And you cynically pointed out that, like, by far his most successful book was a book with a female protagonist. So that likely has a lot to do with it. But I think once you get past that piece, and because the love story isn't central to the plot here, I think the voice works a lot better once you just kind of lean into it.
Yes. And folks, of course, we will acquiesce to the fact that there is a romance in the story. So it's not as though we're not going to acknowledge that it's there or something. It's just more that when you reach the end of the story, you realize, oh, the stuff between Aza and Davis is ultimately just not as important as telling Aza's story of overcoming or surviving. Because, well, we'll talk about the ending.
And the central love in the book is much more about the friendship between Aza and Daisy, for better or for worse, than it is between Aza and Davis. But let me give the plot summary. So our protagonist is Aza Holmes. She's a high school student. As I've already said, she has OCD. And the way this disorder manifests for her is that she's like obsessively terrified of bacteria.
C. diff, come through.
Specifically C. diff. And she constantly keeps like a wound on her finger open so that she can like drain what she believes are the pathogens in her body through this wound on her finger. And honestly, some of the descriptions, like if you have a hard time with this kind of stuff, the book gets very raw at times.
Yes.
Her best friend is Daisy. Daisy is, she writes Star Wars fan fiction. She works every hour at Chuck E. Cheese. And she has a very different life than Aza, not just because of the OCD stuff. Aza also lost her dad when she was really young. Daisy's family lives in poverty in comparison to Aza's family. And so there are some distinctions that become important as the narrative goes on. basically, there's this weird mystery that runs through the book, and we'll talk a little bit about how it works narratively, but a billionaire has gone missing, and it turns out that Aza, after her dad died, was sent to, like, a camp for kids whose parents have died, where she met Davis, the son of this billionaire whose mother had died. And so Daisy really wants the $100,000 reward for information, so they go snooping around. They find information. They also find love. Mm-hmm. And Davis, very concerned about whether they're just there for his money or not, ends up just giving Aza $100,000 so he doesn't have to think about it anymore, which she splits with Daisy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that mystery is there, and they're always trying to pick at it, like a little bit, but it's not the central story.
It's also not important. No.
It's not. The central story is really about Aza and her friendship with Daisy, which comes to a big head when Aza finally reads Daisy's fan fiction. It's important to note that, like, Daisy's, like, a pretty big fan fiction writer. Like, she has tens of thousands of readers every week. There's a character that is clearly based on Aza and not in a flattering way.
No.
And Daisy's been writing about her for years. And of course, Aza has never really taken an interest in anything about Daisy. And so this all comes into a big explosion that ends in a car accident. And Aza ends up hospitalized. Being hospitalized is obviously terrifying for someone who's afraid of C. difficile. And she spirals through her OCD to end up drinking hand sanitizer. And Joe, honestly,
I cannot.
She drinks hand sanitizer at, like, several different points in the book, but there's one point where she does it after making it with Davis because she's so terrified of his pathogens being inside her. And in that scene, Joe, I was everything I could do not to physically vomit myself. Like, I found the way that was written so visceral and upsetting. And then it happens again in the hospital. And so she ends up hospitalized as they try to stabilize her OCD. And so they sort of end up solving the mystery like in, like, a sideways kind of way. There's an art show. I'm not going to get into any of that.
We'll unpack it if we want to.
But in the end, what we have is Aza somewhat stable in her disorder, but no sense that she's, like, quote unquote cured. It was really important, I think, to leave all of those ends untied. Her friendship with Daisy gets repaired. And I think the most important thing is that Aza ends the book with a sense of possibility. I don't even want to say hope, but possibility about her future that she didn't have at the start of the book. She starts to imagine actually going away for university, for example.
And
that's where we leave it.
Yeah, so there's one other significant character we haven't touched on, and that's Aza's mother. So obviously a single woman, she works in the school as a teacher. So it's interesting because she is very much a helicopter parent. Like, she needs to know where Aza is at all times. She worries if she stays out too late. But it's one of those things where she's clearly doing it out of love, but because of Aza's, you know, mental history, she finds it suffocating. So, you know, her mother is trying to be super protective because Aza is the most important person in her life, but all of the caretaking, all the nurturing is actually having the opposite effect, where it feels like she won't let Aza live, and that contributes to some of the spiraling and the intrusive thoughts.
Yes, exactly. There's this sense for Aza that, like, there's a guilt about, you know, her mother's investment in her and the fact that she isn't well and her mother really needs her to be well. And there's, like, this constant tension that comes between those two things. Because, of course, her mom says, like, I can't lose you too. That's actually a lot of pressure.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about the way that these intrusive thoughts are written, because I have never seen anything like this before.
No. So we go through these periods where the intrusive thoughts are in italics and Aza's, I guess, non-intrusive thoughts are in regular text.
It's like her attempts to rationalize. It almost reads like two different characters, but it's presented in blocks of text. So there's no break, which...
Not even punctuation, right? No. It's just text. Yeah. How did you find the experience of reading it?
It's appropriately overwhelming, like, because there's no punctuation, you can't help but continue reading it, and it feels like you're ramping up alongside Aza. I found it incredibly effective, and I, like, sometimes it goes on for a long time. Yeah. And I just wanted it to stop, which is like the desired impact.
Well, Aza describes being caught in these sort of obsessive cycles as being caught in a thought spiral. Mm-hmm. But the spiral is tightening every time. And that's exactly how it feels to read these passages. Like, it's extremely uncomfortable. And, you know, there's this almost relief when you can close the book and put it down. And then you're reminded as soon as you pick it up that, oh, Aza can't do that. Like, Aza's trapped inside this cycling.
Yeah, which is why I found the stuff with her and Daisy so impactful, because it really hurts when we discover that Daisy has been writing about Aza in this way, because we are in tune with Aza. We know what she's going through. And it becomes very clear very quickly, particularly after she reads the fan fiction, that Daisy is on the outside looking in, and she just thinks that she has this kind of absent, narcissistic, self-centered friend.
Yeah.
And I honestly got so mad at Daisy. I texted you and I was like, this Daisy character is basically the equivalent of that one character who we villainized in the Becky Abotelli bisexual book a while back.
Yeah.
I was just like, she's the worst friend. I can't believe her. And I really had to talk myself down because, you know, from Daisy's perspective, all of this is very true. And her fan fiction is the way that she's processing these intrusive thoughts about their friendship.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's the scene where they're fighting that culminates in the car accident.
Mm-hmm. Which is so quintessentially YA. I was like, of course they get into a car accident when they're fighting.
In that passage, we have intrusive thoughts in italics. We have sort of stabilizing thoughts in plain text. And then we have what's being said between Aza and Daisy in quotations. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to follow. And it's really confusing. And then all of a sudden the car is smashed up and you're like, oh, okay. This is what it would feel like. I agree. I think Daisy's a really interesting character because she has obviously bottled all this stuff up. And like a lot of the things she says about Aza, like,
it's not wrong.
No, Aza doesn't know her parents' names or what they do for a living. They've been friends their whole lives. And it's like, whoo. And because of all the ways in which Aza's disability limits her scope and her worldview, like, it never even occurs to her that maybe Daisy would like it if they hung out at her house, for example. And so it's also a really confronting scene because we are 100% Team Aza.
Right.
And we get slapped with the fact that actually, like, some of this is true. Yeah.
To be clear, though, some of it is not true.
Some of it is not
true. Daisy's hangups about being poor and calling Aza rich. I was like, girl, you need to check your privilege. Like, I know that we're living in Indiana and maybe your dollar goes a different way, but Aza is not rich. Like,
no, her mom is a school teacher.
She cannot afford to go to college outside of like a local regional school.
Yeah, no, she's not rich at all. And it's totally true that Daisy's perception is skewed by her own experiences, right? Just like we all are. But I think what's so interesting about that is, like, clearly this has bothered Daisy for so long.
So long.
And there's finally this moment to like let it all out. But the flip side is that Daisy holds no grudges, apologizes freely. Like, when Aza finally says, okay, so what do your parents do for a living? Daisy's like, here's what they do. Like,
yeah, here's a conversation.
There's no resentment. So I think Daisy's a lot better than the Albertalli villain, but I certainly hated her just as much in that moment.
In the moment, it was like an unforgivable sin.
Absolutely.
No, but I love Daisy as a character, and I'm not going to lie. I think I love the depiction of the character in physical form even more in the film.
Yeah.
But okay, let's talk about the flip side of this. So we have Davis, who is our slightly sad, very interested in astronomy, loner figure who has to take care of his younger brother at this palatial mansion.
Where they have a lot of money and no love. The opposite of what's... It's a Tuatara, Joe.
Here was the part of the story I could not care about. It just, it felt like one quirky bit too much.
Too far, yeah.
I was like, I get it. Millionaires, billionaires, they're eccentric, they're weirdos. I was, every time we talked about this lizard, I was just like, I don't care!
So just to fill you in, if you haven't read the book, there's a Tuatara that lives on the property. It basically has its own house attached to the pool. Mm-hmm. It has its own caretaker, which, by the way, the children don't actually even have their own caretaker. But
no.
But Tuatara does. And one of the sort of tensions in the book is that Davis's father has left everything to mm-hmm. the Tuatara because he's obsessed with not aging. Right. And so the idea is that, like, this Tuatara, which, like, you can trace genetically back to dinosaurs, has some secret to longevity.
Mm-hmm.
It's also important to know that Davis's dad is a criminal. That's why he's gone on the run. He's not gone missing, like, because somebody has murdered him. He's gone missing because he's trying to evade arrest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, this all spitballs into some pretty clear thematic interest that the book has, right? Yeah. Like, so we've got dead or absent fathers.
Yes.
And then we've also got this interest in, like, what does money buy you? Is it happiness? And what even is happiness when everybody is going through their own private struggles?
And so there's this timeline, because Russell Pickett has gone missing and the body has not been found, as long as he is in that limbo state, Davis and his brother basically have 7 years with the family fortune before mm-hmm. it all gets handed over to the Tuatara.
Yeah.
So there's this sense of, like, okay, that will get them out on their own and established in their, you know, university or whatever, and then they will just be middle-class kids because they'll mm-hmm. have, you know, they'll have had their educations paid for, but that's it.
Right.
And so when at the end, Daisy and Aza actually find the body, or they mm-hmm. they find a strange smell that they think is the body.
It's not just raw sewage. It smells like rotting corpse.
Oh, it smells like old rich guy. They tell Davis, and Davis has to make the decision, like, do I keep this secret and keep living comfortably for my 7 years, or mm-hmm. do I tell the truth? And of course, right. he's a boy love interest in a YA, so he tells the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, I mean, I don't think that Noah, the younger brother, is a real character. He's
no.
a bit of an emotionally manipulative signifier,
yes.
but I think it tells us a lot about who Davis is, that he sees how upset his younger brother is over the disappearance of their father, because Noah can't process, like, the limbo yeah. is really hard on Noah. And
basically, Noah believes that his dad is still alive and
yes.
just not reaching out to them, which is,
yes.
Davis determines, way worse than just finding the body and moving on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the sort of absence of their father is echoed by the absence of Aza's dead father, whom she keeps alive via his car, as well as a phone that she keeps in the boot of the car that has old family photos. So, of course, when we get into the car accident, the car is destroyed, as is the phone, and it's another emotional breaking point.
Yeah, exactly. There's a way in which, you know, the OCD for Aza manifests in her desire to control the situations. And so, of course, as the novel progresses, she slowly loses control of each mm-hmm. and every one of the things that she had been kind of holding on to.
Yeah, but it's interesting because, I mean, yeah, it definitely forces her to a breaking point that ends in hospitalization. But in true YA form, it also offers her that glimpse of, okay, this is a turning point. You can start to address it. Like, you know, she's supposed to be on medication, but she refuses to take it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until she's hospitalized that she really starts to double down on her own recovery, or even just managing her illness so that she can live.
Yeah, she has to kind of come to this. I mean, it really is a rock bottom, the drinking of the hand sanitizer, probably most emblematic of that. It's really important that she starts to imagine a point, right? And really mm-hmm. what happens is she starts to wonder about what her future might be. And that's what that and the rock bottom allow her to start actually taking getting better seriously, because she's been on prescription medications, but she's never taken them consistently. She's
yeah.
never really been fully honest with her therapist. So there's all kinds of ways in which she's gotten in her own way.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the book, we see those barriers being lifted.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about the ending before we transition over to the film, because I got to tell you, I don't like it.
Okay, tell me what you don't like.
So you suggested that the book doesn't end with a kind of certainty that promises she's going to be okay, but it does offer her like a path. Mm-hmm. And I would actually disagree with that, because there's this portion of text that says she grows up and she gets married and she has kids, and it's not easy because at one point she does have to be hospitalized mm-hmm. again and so on. But this moment of projecting forward, you and I have talked about this repeatedly, it actually removes the YA-ness yep. of it. And, you know, there's a Vanity Fair piece that we'll link to in the show notes where John Green talks about why he did it this way. It's because he couldn't crack the end of it. And I think for his own health and recovery, like from his position as a de facto surrogate, like Aza is him, mm-hmm. I think he needed to offer this kind of hopefulness for the future. And I didn't want that. Like, I wanted some kind of path, but I didn't like knowing plot beats of where Aza's life would go.
Yeah. So John Green says in a statement about this that he sort of breaks his own cardinal rule of YA in mm-hmm. that he zooms out. And one of the things that, like him or not, he never does the sort of future.
And then it was better.
Yeah, exactly. But in this book, what we have is this flash forward where we discover that Aza is actually writing this story from her adult self. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it entirely removes the YA frame. It becomes, in fact, exactly what we talked about in other contexts, an adult novel, really, a retrospective on someone's youth, on someone's childhood. Mm-hmm. And Green talks about this as his big farewell to this kind of storytelling, that by right. allowing himself to step into the future and tell Aza's adult self future story, he's effectively like walking away from the genre of YA entirely.
Mm-hmm. Which is great for him, and it doesn't work for me as a reader. Like, I like that. Snip it out. It has no place here.
I don't feel so strongly about it, because I don't think it's... I didn't read it as literally as you did, I think. Like,
okay. You read it as like a hypothetical.
Yeah, like here are future possible selves. And I think the fact that we're left open to these moments of struggle, like we're told, you know, Aza will have children, but Aza will not be able to manage it and be hospitalized, but then she will get better. Mm-hmm. I read it more as like, here are possible futures, but in all of them, you live. Like in right. all of them, you figure it out. And I was okay with that. I definitely agree that it's not a YA choice. Mm-hmm. And I do think it symbolizes something about Green's relationship to the genre entirely, but I didn't dislike it.
Okay. Yeah, to me, it just felt almost too pat. And one of the things, you know, as you said, I'm not his biggest fan. I've been highly critical of a lot of aspects of his work. And one thing I've always appreciated, particularly in a lot of the texts that we've talked about that deal with mental illness, is it's so easy to want to suggest that things can be solved or things mm-hmm. will be fixed, right? And John Green typically doesn't do that. Like, he has a note of finality in a lot of his books, but it's not a it gets better moment. And that's what this felt like.
In The Fault in Our Stars, it's literally, and they're dead.
And they're dead. But even that offers a sort of like romanticism. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I get that this is probably therapeutic for him, and it does suggest a shift in his own personal life, his own work, and so on. I guess I didn't want that. I'm happy that he found it, mm-hmm. but I didn't want him to share it with me.
That's fair.
Okay, well, why don't we talk about this movie?
Yeah, let's do it.
Your body is nothing but a host to a massive collection of parasitic organisms ready to cause infection, ready to cause infection, ready to cause infection. You can feel them living and breeding and dying inside of you.
Aza!
Yeah, yeah?
Thought spiral?
What are you thinking?
This water has to be like 50% urine.
That's the good half.
Sorry.
I was thinking it's not fair.
Okay, so plenty of people with anxiety disorder have fulfilling romantic relationships.
Hi.
Hi.
You and Davis used to be friends.
For one summer at camp.
Look at you!
I can't date anyone, you know that.
I don't know that. Why can't you?
You're sweating. They probably think you're just a sweaty freak. You can't have a boyfriend, you can't go to college, and you can't even control your own brain.
People think I'm completely crazy.
No, he doesn't.
And things aren't exactly my strong suit.
I'm sort of a new thing, and you're doing fine with me.
I swear to God, he's so smitten.
How do you know? Because I have eyes.
How come it's so easy for me to talk to you?
Maybe because our hearts are broken in the same places.
Being intimate's intimidating for everyone.
I bet that if you guys actually kissed, you would not be thinking about 80 million microbes.
Aza, for once in your life, do not overthink this.
Okay. So Turtles All the Way Down is from director Hannah Marks, who is formerly an actor who pitched herself as a, like, I'm a super fan. Please let me make this movie on your behalf because I know how personal it is to you.
Yeah. And John Green's been pretty involved in the film. I think he's formally an executive producer on it.
Yes.
But mm-hmm. he's also like, he posted a lot of pictures from set and mm-hmm. he's clearly very close to both Hannah Marks and the actresses who play the two main characters.
Yes. So the screenplay is written by Elizabeth Berger as well as Isaac Aptaker and the cast, as you mentioned. So we've got Isabella Merced as Aza, and we've seen her before. So I don't remember the character at all, but she played Julie in Let It Snow.
Oh, okay.
I know. I'm like, okay, I guess. Sure. We have Cree as Daisy Ramirez. And I'm not going to lie, I think it was always going to be a showstopper role, but this is just fun. Like, this character is so enjoyable on
screen.
She's
so good. Yeah.
We've also got Felix Millard as Davis. I couldn't tell he was Australian. Could you?
No, I could not.
Okay. Good on him for the accent work then. We have Judy Reyes as mom extraordinaire Gina.
So happy to see her back on screen.
Always and forever.
Always.
Not the greatest mom role ever. This is very classic YA mom where it's like just enough to help move the story a little bit forward, ensure that we acknowledge, oh, yeah, this character has a parent involved.
Yeah.
Yeah. We also have Malik Johnson as Michael. That is Daisy's love interest, who I did not like his art in the film compared to what his project is in the book. I thought it was really striking in the book.
Yeah, I agree completely.
And then we also have J. Smith Cameron, who folks will recognize from Succession as a made-for-the-film character, Professor Abbott. So we've got Aza, who's obsessed with her TED Talks, and it spirals.
I hated this choice. Sorry, I was trying to hold it until you finished your sentence, Joe, but I hated this choice. I love everything about the movie, but I hate the Professor Abbott choice.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah. Explain.
I think because all of the sort of moments of realization that Daisy gets in the book are given to Professor Abbott. And so instead of it being kind of the two girls merging their shared wisdom to figure out a way to help Aza move through life, we have this sort of deus ex machina god professor character who comes down and imports the wisdom. Okay. And I also, I get it as, because what happens is we have Northwestern then as like this goal that Aza has that her mom thinks she can't do.
Right.
Whereas it's sort of just the idea of moving away in like a general sense that we have in the book. There's no sort of North Star we're aiming towards.
No.
And I get that that's much more cinematic to have like a focus, but I super didn't like Daisy's best lines go into this rich professor lady.
I can definitely understand where you're coming from. It is a weird moment. I mean, sometimes I forgot that Davis was rich in the book, even though there were certain key things where, you know, Aza would go over and visit him and it would be like, let's hang out by the pool, let's go to the golf course. And it was all on his property. So there were little reminders that, oh yeah, he was fabulously wealthy. But the film, it's like, let's get on a personal jet and fly to Chicago.
I didn't love that either, to be honest.
It was a bizarre moment. I think I was more comfortable with this because I actually love J. Smith Cameron as an actor. So
she's lovely.
Was delighted to see her. I thought it was a genuinely emotional moment where we get the title explanation of the turtles all the way down. And that's how you know that you're real, because you feel something and you're not trying to get to the bottom of it. But I can totally take your point that, yeah, it does feel like, oh, let's make a new character and give all the good stuff to them.
Exactly. For Daisy. Justice for Daisy.
Justice for Daisy. I don't know. I think Cree does an amazing job with what she's given. So, yeah. Okay. Well, we talked a lot about how the intrusive thoughts are negotiated or presented in the book. What did you think of the visual depiction?
I really loved it. I was worried going into it. I know. Mm-hmm. But I really loved it. It reminded me of some of the most effective uses of this kind of jump cut, frenetically paced, spiraling kind of. Like, it made me think of when Sherlock Holmes is following a thread in the BBC series.
Yep.
Or the way they used to depict, like, House going in and exploring, like, a path of thought. Like, it sort of goes into his brain and, like... And I'm realizing as I'm saying this out loud that both of these are Sherlock Holmes references, and so too is Asa Holmes's last name. So I'm seeing that connection here.
Yep.
Which John Green, by the way, has said is intentional. He wanted to create a mystery story where the detective isn't, like, better because they have some sort of obsessive tendencies, because in his life, it's never made anything better. And so here, it doesn't make it easier for Asa to solve the crime either.
Yeah, I appreciated even giving Daisy a line in the screenplay where she says, ugh, why can't you have the helpful kind of OCD?
Well, yeah, it's definitely a vibe. So for me, it resonated with all of those kinds of things that have always really worked for me visually. Mm-hmm. You and I often have different reactions to this kind of thing, though. So how was it for you?
I also liked it. Yeah. So, folks, if you haven't seen the film, visualize extreme close-ups of bacteria edited into, as you suggested, Brenna, like a frenetic montage. But we've got a really good scratchy kind of sound effect that is grating and abrasive. And it feels like if this was living inside of your head, it's very easy to imagine why Asa wouldn't be able to follow conversation, or she would be continually distracted or unable to escape from the loop.
Yeah, it worked really well. And it has almost, not quite as effective as how intense it feels on the page, but pretty close, way closer than I thought they'd get.
Yeah, it was interesting because I was curious to see how often Hannah Marks and the creative team was going to go back to this, because obviously we get an escalation in the books. And I was actually surprised at how judicious they are. So yeah, it comes up, but not as often and not for as prolonged a period as I thought. But I will say the editing of this and then watching Asa just down all of the hand sanitizer in the hospital, because it just felt like it was so much more extreme in that moment. Like, we had seen glimpses or flashes of it before, and this was sustained, and it felt like it was never ending. Like, when she kept going back get more and more hand sanitizer, you just want to scream at her to stop.
And you can hear her mom's voice, and it doesn't even matter. Like, her mom is begging her to stop, and she can't even hear it. She can't even engage with that. Oh my God.
Yeah, it's almost like she's on autopilot. She just has to do whatever she can to get her body cleansed. And of course, you're like, the book makes it much more explicit just how damaging it would be to consume. You know, you think, oh, hand sanitizer, it's alcohol, it would be bad for you to consume. It's like, no, this is pure alcohol.
Yeah.
It would kill you.
And in the book, of course, it's much clearer, too, that the damage she sustained in the car accident is a lacerated liver. So you're imagining, like, the liver trying to process, like, just pure alcohol from this hand sanitizer. Like, oh, God. Mm-mm.
Bad combo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think the other significant thing, and I think you and I are on slightly different wavelengths than this, is I found that there was a really significant over-reliance on musicality. So we are doing way too many needle drops in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, it is a YA movie and it feels like it on the soundtrack, that's for sure.
To the point where I thought, oh, do we also have a promotional soundtrack that we're trying to sell? Like, do I need to go to Spotify to download this? It was a little too much for me. Like, at times it felt like it was overcompensating. And this is tricky, right? Because I think the book is unlike most YA. But I was surprised in that Vanity Fair article to learn that this was originally slated to go theatrical, the film was, mm-hmm. because I don't see this as marketable.
That's so interesting. Yeah, it was supposed to be a Fox 2000 production. And of course, when Disney bought Fox and closed Fox 2000, this
went
into...
goodbye. Haha, we're not releasing any of your movies.
Yeah. And so eventually New Line Cinema bought it, sold it to HBO for release. So yeah, it's had a tumultuous period. I mean, it's been, I think it was optioned in 2017. And
I could have sworn that we talked about this in about the first or second year of the podcast.
Yeah. No, I'm sure we did, because I was reading the book as soon as it came out. And I think it was optioned like right at the time
was released. Yeah. Because, of course, he's a huge best-selling author.
And literally every single one of his books has been adapted. So it was weird that this one took so long. I see it as a theatrical release of the, like, Juno era, which is to say, I don't think Juno would get a theatrical release anymore either. No, you know what I mean?
No.
So, yeah, I agree with you from that perspective. Like, I think this is clear streamer and it's clear Max territory. Like, if we think about the other YA movies we've seen that went to Max first, this falls right in line with them.
Right.
But I also think it's a shame because if you compare this depiction of OCD to, like, anything else we've seen, there's nothing like it. And it seems so – it just seems like such an indicator of the moment we're in media, as everything is, like, contracting again and what stories get wide release and whose stories get told. It's just, like – it's just another example, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I do feel the same way. I mean, I think that this would be a hugely challenging film to try to inspire people to come out to theaters. Like, I can envision, because I never watched the trailer because I knew that we were just going to cover it. Mm-hmm. But I'm imagining that you would lean on the romance. And the reality is that you're going to have teen girls walk out of a theater completely unimpressed because what do you mean they don't end up together? What do you mean Davis moves away at the drop of a hat? Like, where is my happy ending? And, you know, The Fault in Our Stars doesn't have that. But as I said, it's got that romanticism to it. Like, they die
kind of Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think you would have a lot of unsatisfied customers and that wouldn't do well for this. But at the same time, even, you know, we do inclusive flip for this.
Yeah, we
do. Honestly, I cannot praise the two lead actresses enough because I think, you know, we talked a lot about how Cree makes Daisy so fun and so lovable, which makes it hard when she betrays Aza. Mm-hmm. But Isabella Merced is doing ridiculous work here to make this character empathetic, but also vulnerable, but also you're just like, what the heck are you doing, girl?
Yeah. No, they're both excellent. And I saw an interview with Hannah Marks and John Green, which talked about the casting. Mm-hmm. And they both said, you know, America has this conception of what it is to be from the Midwest and what it is to be from Indianapolis. But Indianapolis is an incredibly metropolitan space. There there's a huge Latinx community in Indianapolis. It made absolute sense to have these two actresses in these roles. And I just thought that was so cool.
Right. Oh, you mean looking at where a story is set and recognizing that not everybody is white and then casting appropriately? What a novel concept.
But also asking American filmmakers generally to look at the Midwest a little differently, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's a really important piece of it too. So often, and I think we do this as Canadians all the time. We like stereotype particular areas of the U.S. because we know 100%. Nothing about them. And like, so I thought this was such a neat choice. And it obviously doesn't hurt that, like, I can't imagine two more exceptional actresses in these roles. Like, I just can't.
Yeah, considering how challenging the subject matter is, like, this is a confronting film. It's not often an enjoyable movie to watch, even though some parts of it are very joyous and, you know, the people are easy, like, oh no, stunningly gorgeous to look at. But, like, this is a hard watch and this is a hard sell, but it can also be very badly done if you don't have the right people in these roles.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. This kind of a depiction of sort of such an internal character, right? Like, so much of Aza's problem is that she doesn't tell us how she's feeling. She lives inside her head. This depiction is just, it's spot on. It's really, really strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one final thing. I mean, I know that we've teased about how, oh, this is probably the last time we'll ever do this. Are you not surprised that we haven't seen an adaptation of Will Grayson, Will Grayson?
Oh, it's an interesting question. Yeah. I mean, am I surprised we haven't seen one? You'd think it would be an easy book to adapt, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you've got two broad characters and two big storylines. I don't know. Maybe it's hard to secure the rights with two authors.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I was just surprised because I'm like, oh, it's David Levithan. So yeah. We've seen multiple books from him also adapted. So I'm just surprised that we have two eminently adaptable authors writing on a single text. Surely you can find a way to make that work.
Well, I appreciate you giving me hope that we're going to do another John Green book in the future. I'm really grateful for that. Thank you.
Yeah, there you go. Should we do some YA bingo?
Let's do it.
Bingo!
Not a good bingo.
I'm going to get abuse out of the way right off the top.
But also ableism, right? Like, Aza is constantly aware of the ways in which she is, like, not quote-unquote normal and the ways that she doesn't fit. So, yeah, I think both.
Yeah, and I really appreciate the conversations that she has with her therapist, Dr. Singh, who acknowledges we need to stop using the word normal.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's really well done. Honestly, those therapy scenes are some of my favorite therapy scenes in cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, house porn for the estate that Davis lives in.
Oh my, indeed.
I want a house that's so big that you need a golf course to get from place to place on the property. Or golf cart.
Property taxes, though. Oof.
Yeah, but the Tuatara is paying them.
So. There we go. Yeah. You know what? Charge everything to the lizard.
I'm going to go with a dead body. We got two dead dads and dead mom.
Indeed, yes.
Obviously, we've got a sexual awakening scene in the pool. I was going to say, like, have we considered in a future bingo board just put the pool on the bingo board? Because so many of these movies have a pool.
We love a pool, yeah.
We love a pool. Oh, we've already talked about inclusion flip.
Mm-hmm.
And we've already talked about our female director. But what else do you have?
Okay, so I have musicality.
Nice. Yeah. Too much for you.
A little too much for me, but that's okay. We also have good friendships.
Mm, yeah.
What about hollow romances? I would say almost appropriately for the book, Daisy and Michael's relationship, which starts out hot and heavy and then fades away pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think so too. I also just really appreciated that the loves that carry the characters through are like Davis's love for Noah moves their plot forward.
Right.
Daisy's love for Aza moves their plot forward. And Aza's love for her mom moves their plot forward. Like, it's not romantic love. And there's this line in the book that's like, we become who we are through love. And it was really neat to not see that focused on romantic love in both cases. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, we love a text that isn't centrally focused on romantic love.
We sure do.
Yeah. Okay, so I've got a bunch more.
Go for it.
I also have coincidental classes because we literally road trip to Chicago so that we can take in Dr. Abbott's class.
Which is basically a TED Talk, by the way.
To which I'm like, girl, if you can get paid to deliver that course and also money from the TED Talk on YouTube, love it for you. We also have many perfect dates, even though they often end badly because Aza ends up in her intrusive thoughts. Up until that point, many of these dates with Davis are like swoon worthy.
Super cute. Yeah.
Yeah.
We have borrowed time.
Okay.
Because only a matter of time before they find the body, but also in a very literal sense, Davis and Noah have 7 years. Like, no matter what else happens, in 7 years, it's all over for them.
Right.
And also, there is a sense, like, once Aza starts drinking the hand sanitizer, this is only going one of two ways. She's either going to stabilize or she's going to die.
Yeah. And she was never going to stabilize. Not on her own.
No. No.
Okay, I think that's all I have, and it's a very healthy representation, but not correctly aligned.
See, John Green betrayed you again.
Couldn't even give me this. I don't want to circle back, considering that we're already on to bingo, but I feel like we haven't talked about class very much. Like, I know we talked about Daisy's sort of misinterpretation of wealth, but what do you think about the way money is handled in the film?
It's interesting because I think this also is some John Green self-insertion.
Mm-hmm.
Anxiety over wealth. He's talked about this, like, openly on his social media about, like, what it is for your life to change that dramatically with the wealth that he acquired through The Fault in Our Stars. But I think it's really interesting that, like, 201, money makes people make bad choices in this book, like, across the board.
Yeah.
And there's this real sense that, you know, it's almost like the level of income that Aza has is kind of ideal. Like, honestly, she's not tortured by need, but she's also not ruined by wealth. And Davis's desire to give them money so that he would have to stop thinking about whether or not they were after his money, I think, is really emblematic of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, of course, we get to judge Daisy for making extremely poor financial decisions. Like, the minute she gets a penny, she spends it. And as adults, you cringe. But as someone who considers himself poor and looks at what other people have, it makes perfect sense that she would immediately buy herself a car.
Well, and I love her point to Aza when Aza is being, like, super judgmental. Aza's like, yeah, you already had a car. You already had a computer. Like, when I try to, like, do everything for school on my phone, that actually sucks and is hard. It's like, you know what? Fair point, Daisy.
Yeah.
And Daisy works so hard. Like,
so hard.
One of the core distinctions between Aza and Daisy is that she does have to work to save up for university. So, of course, for her, $50,000 is, like, a life-changing amount of money.
Life-changing.
And she has to give half of it to her sister anyway.
I do love that plot point, Even though we lose it in the film, I was like, okay, it makes sense because you've got too much going on already, but...
Yeah.
Okay. So that's Turtles All the Way Down.
Yeah. So, folks, if you read or watched this and have thoughts, we'd love to hear them. You can find us on social media at HKHSPod or on the hashtag HKHSPod. Joe, where do they find you?
I can be reached at B Stole My Remote, and that's the letter B.
And I'm at Brenna C. Gray, that's Gray with an A. And if you want to put anything in the mailbag, like make Joe keep talking about John Green books forever and ever.
How dare.
It's hkhspod@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe.
Yes.
Next week we are returning maybe to like G-rated Red, White, and Royal Blue territory, maybe?
Somewhere between Red, White, and Royal Blue and Heartstopper, because we're going for the uber swoon-worthy queer romance Like Real People Do by E.L. Massey.
My favorite thing about this book, Joe, is the fact that neither one of us knows how it got on our programming calendar.
No.
You thought it was me, and I thought it was you, and it's here now, and we're talking about it next week.
Yeah, folks, if you ever wanted to read a queer love story about a brown figure skater who falls in love with a white hockey captain, this is your time.
Here we go. So fans of Check Please, I think, might be interested in this one.
For sure.
But yeah, that's where we're headed next week. And then in a couple weeks' time, we're going to check out a big change of pace. We're going to check out Aquamarine by Alice Hoffman and its movie adaptation.
Yes, it's all about that summer mermaid romance.
You could definitely not put these three episodes in like a time capsule and be like, this is what our show's about, because they're so wildly different. Or maybe you could. That's maybe what we like about our
show. You know what? I was actually going to say, I think you're being facetious, but I'm pretty sure you're telling the truth.
Perfect. Okay, folks. So until next time, I will see you on the page.
And I will see you on the screen. It actually hit harder, I think, as a result, because it felt like it was just so much bigger, more sort of blah.
Okay. We obviously have a, well, no, I don't know where I was going there.